Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are having a wide-ranging conversation with longtime organizer Jane McAlevey, and there is so much to talk about. Last Wednesday, the Supreme Court struck a devastating blow to unions and union organization. Earlier this year, 20,000 teachers in West Virginia sparked a nationwide movement when they walked off the job to protest low wages, inadequate and expensive health care, and education budget cuts. We saw similar uprisings in Oklahoma, Kentucky, Arizona, and Colorado. After mass pressure from Disney's 9,500 workers, Disney recently announced plans to increase its minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2020, but the union says that is not enough. And in New York, where six drivers have taken their own lives since September, the New York Taxi Workers Alliance have had daily actions to pressure New York's government to regulate Uber and Lyft and create a level playing field. Joining us to talk about workers' rights, unions, and power is Jane McAlevey, a longtime organizer, author, and scholar. Jane is author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell. She's also author of No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. And her forthcoming book is Striking Back. It's about organizing, power, and strategy. And Jane McAlevey joins me in studio. Hi, Jane. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. It's great to be here.
I'm so glad to have you with us. We've got a lot to talk about. Let's talk about big picture stuff first. What I so appreciate about your work is your focus on power and the fact that the Republican Party has done really an amazing job of changing the rules so the minority is making the decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the truth is, it's sort of always been true, right, in our country. It's just that they've really seriously stacked the deck at this point. And you can almost watch them systematically making it more secure for a rule by, let's just say, an extreme minority going forward in this country. So I'm going to put the Janus context, which was, of course, the case that claimed some kind of First Amendment violation for a worker to have to pay the equivalent of taxes to work in the workforce they work in. Let's sort of come back to that, because I want to put the big case from Wednesday in the context of other cases the Supreme Court made this past cycle, the session, and to what the Supreme Court's been doing for the last 5 to 7 years. Essentially, as the country has become more clearly ethnically and racially diverse, it's been more and more important for the white nationalist crowd, which is now occupying the White House, sadly, for the white nationalist crowd to sort of use a drumbeat, right? When we saw that when Trump began the birther movement. It's actually 2007, I think, they start the birther movement. So Trump himself is on sort of 11 years now of raising the white nationalist flag to rally and divide, to rally white people and to divide and conquer the working class. That's essentially what he's doing. So that's a strategy. We can come back to the strategy, right? But in terms of the power analysis, part of what began to happen around the election of Obama was that demographers began to say the United States is going to be a majority-minority country, by which they mean most people in the United States will be people of color. Hooray, says Jane on air. Hooray, for sure. But what that meant was it solidified and crystallized for the super wealthy, which are largely white men in the decision-making seats, that they had to get clever fast about how to cement their ability to rule this country against the will of the vast majority of people who live in the United States. And by the way, by extrapolation, since we're doing a lot of damage outside of this country, also, how do we enforce similarly a rule by a super small corporate elite dominated by straight white men who make in excess of, I'm looking at the numbers from 20, this is from 2013, to make the Forbes 400, you had to have no less than $1.7 billion. And the truth is they were all worth quite a bit more than that. So 400 players at corporations in this country are determining how to keep control over the vast majority of women, women of color, people of color, and certainly economically less fortunate people, right? So that's – so the Supreme Court essentially has been rolling back systematically for the last sort of three or four sessions. They've been systematically rolling back things that would guarantee us sort of economic rights. That relates to the union, the foundations of unions, how can we sustain good unions. There's been three systematic attacks on unions just since 2010. The first was Knox v. SEIU, which set up something called Harris v. Quinn, which then set up the ruling that we just saw last week on the very last day of the court, which is when they say what they think of as their most important decisions. And then several days before that, they ruled on a case that solidified the right for Texas to gerrymander people of color right out of the having any power in their elections. And then before that. So if you look at just the last few years at just the U.S. Supreme Court, this is just one aspect to have the exercise power. There are many more aspects which we should get to about how they're exercising power, they being corporate sort of Forbes 400. If I just stick with the Forbes 400 list, it's an obscene amount of money in the hands of a handful, a tiny handful of people. So the Supreme Court has been systematically rolling back affirmative action and then structurally the Voting Rights Act, as well as union rights and workers' rights in this country. And if you look at that as a complete whole, the problem with our movement is we have folks who look at trade unions, folks who look at gender, folks who look at racial and ethnic identity, so-called politics. And what we don't do is sort of look as a whole movement at the crisis of power that we're experiencing. My obsession is sort of, I think, because I've worked in almost all of these sectors in our progressive movement, is looking across the silos in our movement and saying, for goodness sake, people, sit up and understand that every single one of these attacks on women's rights, on the right to an abortion, on the right to clean water, on the right to clean air, on the right to vote, and now fundamentally on the right to have to expect that a worker in a unionized facility where workers vote by majority should have the duty to pay essentially taxes. Like, this is not, these are not individual Supreme Court attacks. They are an attack that is about cementing rule by economic, ethnic, and racial and gender minorities in this country.
Let's talk more about minority rules, because unfortunately, this does not get that much attention in the media. Nancy McLean wrote an amazing book called Democracy in Chains and looks at the history of how we got to this point where the minority rules. How do you explain this concept to someone who doesn't know that much about it or how we got here?
Yep. I mean, first of all, it's sort of always been this way, right? If we go all the way back, and there's so much good literature coming out now. Part of the problem, of course, is that what's free and blasted into tired people's households is actually Fox News, not Nancy McLean's book or mine or your call, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Sadly, mm-hmm. We might say. So how do you explain it? I mean, I think one simple way to explain it is that not one of these crazy white nationalist or militaristic right-wing presidents have actually won the popular vote. Like, it wasn't true when I was stuck in Florida on the Florida recount. Like, to me, that was the first time that I realized, wow, they're really cementing rule by the minority, right? As one of a handful of veterans who survived, who got sent to and survived the Florida recount, that was when it first occurred to me, wow, I just experienced a coup as a young organizer working for the National Labor Movement and sent in, like, the night that they were calling Florida Gore, Florida Bush, Florida Gore. You know, a bunch of us who were on the national organizing team were getting text messages saying, get to Florida on the next plane, don't call, just go. And I woke up the day after the 2000 election in Florida, and for the next 5 to 6 weeks, besides that I wrote a great criticism about the Democratic Party's acquiescence to losing control of the country in 2000, the beginning of my first book, it was also when I sat up and realized they are serious about holding control of this country when it's clear they're not going to win the popular vote. And we are certainly seeing that in every election, essentially, since then. They're not winning the national popular vote, and they're finding ways to maintain control of the most important apparatuses of decision-making in our country.
And can we go back to that point? Because I think it's so important to remember these events. In Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, I remember reading about your criticism of Al Gore and the Democratic Party and how they dealt with that. Remind us what happened there.
Oh, my God.
It's important because people are so angry right now. And after Kennedy announced he was going to retire, people got really nasty messages. People who maybe didn't support Hillary or weren't 100% on board with her, people got nasty messages saying, this is your fault.
Yeah. So what's interesting is, I think in general, it's going to be important to talk about the Democratic Party's complicity with complicity is the right word, with essentially enabling the corporate class to maintain control over this country. Sadly, the Democratic Party, if you look at contributions and donations, well, and again, it takes us back to the U.S. Supreme Court, right? Because, of course, the Citizens United decision, along with several others, that wasn't the only one. It's very important, people who don't pay attention to the Supreme Court, and again, I wouldn't necessarily wish it on people, but for those of us who do pay attention to it, even in the case of, there's been several whacks at voting rights. One is specifically taking an act, the Voting Rights Act, right, that actually was created in this country to overcome myriad laws which hem in Black and Latinos from voting in this country. But similar to that, the Citizens United ruling, like McCutcheon, like several others, Vallejo versus Buckley, actually going back into the late 70s, they always do them in a series of cases. They realize they can't overnight, they being the corporate right, they can't sort of overnight just make it too obvious what they're doing. So in all these cases, the attack on unions, the attack on voting rights, the attack on affirmative action, the attack on choice and abortion, the attack on women's right to control their bodies, and the attack that has led to a corporation being ruled as the same as a quote-unquote citizen when it comes to voting and campaign contributions in this country. So that's what Citizens United did. And by the way, that was Kennedy, as in the one that they're all talking about as a savior, who's stepping down from the Supreme Court right now. So for me, again, it's a total package. One of the most it's hard to decide which of those are most devastating, and I think that's the problem. We can't. Mm-hmm. If I just had a flip chart and I began to write down every one of the cases I just named, we're up to about 12 decisive cases that have made it so that we are complicit. But here's the thing. So the Democratic Party, let's just go back to one of many, sorry to say. I know we would all rather we were back in the Obama era. I would too. But I even think in the Obama era, there was a series of decisions that left even the Obama era complicit with a lot of the bad things that are happening right now, whether it's the union front, the voting rights front, gender, et cetera. One of them was when Mitch McConnell in the Senate, we're not even going to let a hearing happen on whether or not to approve the Supreme Court. There was a series of things that the Obama administration did in its final year that we're now experiencing essentially a death blow. In fact, people will die from the decisions that this current government is making. So one was they were so sure, as were the Clinton people, because they represent the same wing of the Democratic Party, even though they ran against each other. They represent the corporate neoliberal wing of the Democratic Party, which was complicit in helping to wipe out unions, which was complicit in helping to damper down the ability of a unified working class to fight back. And by the way, when I say working class, can I be super clear? I do not mean white. The working class in this country is anything but white. It is white and many other shades of whatever we all are. So when I say working class for the next 40 minutes, I mean a multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-gendered, textured working class, which is not white men in the Midwest, which they'd like people to believe. So there were several things that were done at the end of that sort of that last year. I mean, if you could just redo Obama's last 12 months, we wouldn't be in the situation we're in. First of all, they literally allowed McConnell. They were so confident that Clinton would win. It was so out of their mind that Trump could win. They're so tone deaf. The corporate rich Democratic elite are so tone deaf to the misery going on in this country that it never really occurred to them that Trump could win. Now they're going to blame it on a Russia and they're going to blame it on this and that, whatever, whatever. For those of us in the field, and what I say in the new preface to the reissued version of my book, No Shortcuts, is that, you know, I knew that Trump was going to win and I predicted it a year before he won in multiple places, including in The Nation magazine. So I wasn't fooled. I was totally freaked out the entire year thinking they don't understand that this guy is both going to win the Republican Party nomination and he's going to go on to win the country because they can't analyze power very well. So what did they do? What complicity did the Democratic corporate elite play in just that last year of Obama's administration? They didn't force the kind of fight that the Republicans are going to force right now to insist they're going to have their vote. They don't care what's fair. Like all these Democratic Party people, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, I just need to say this online, you both need to step down now. They just need to resign because their leadership is stale and really old and it's made very poor decisions. So one was letting Mitch McConnell not have his hand forced so that we could have Garland, we could have a different Supreme Court judge right now, we wouldn't even be having the discussion we're having today. So that's on the Obama administration, and that's on the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. That's who said, oh, it's okay. Like, could you imagine the Republicans, they'd close the building down until they got their vote, which is what they're going to do right now, right? So this also links me back to Florida and the complicity of the Democrats my entire adult life is like when I was in the Florida recount and your question way back, like, what did they do to be complicit? Literally, those of us on the ground, I woke up at 5 a.m. and at the West Palm Beach or Palm Beach Airport the next morning, one of the very first people on the ground, just because I was flying down from the East Coast. It was a quick flight. And almost from the time we got there, the position of the Democratic Party leadership, Al Gore's people, the same people who were the Clinton people, the same people who actually were the Obama people, right? The neoliberal corporate class wing of wealthy people in the party who believe in, like, they believe in choice. They might believe in sort of some diversity goals, but they definitely don't believe in economic liberation for the masses of the working people in this country. And that's what has split the Democratic Party. So when I went to Florida as a young organizer, ordered to get there to sort of help figure out what was going on in the Florida recount, as I talk about in my first book, it was the most maddening thing every day. It was like watching a car crash happening and knowing that if I just turned the wheel a hair, the car wouldn't crash, and then having the Democratic Party and Al Gore's lawyers pulling hard on the wheel in the other direction so that we could have a car crash. What we needed to do was have immediate rallies and direct actions. There were, as I say in the beginning of the book, and I am not exaggerating, there were tens of thousands of people in South Florida alone, because who's there? New York City's retirees. So there were tens of thousands of retired union members, black and white, from the strongest generation, what we think of now as sort of the baby boomers who are in retirement, like that retiree class who realized the benefits of a strong union movement, who saw their lives and their kids' lives improving. That's who had retired to South Florida. So I'm on the ground. I'm in Florida. What do I have in front of me? I have the list of all of the retirees and the voters from all the teachers' unions, the public service unions in New York, and half of them are living down there. They're blacks and they're Jews and they're all my people from New York. And I'm like, we need to have massive protests right now in the street to say, don't you dare steal this election. We were I was threatened to be sent home several times from the evening debriefs because I was on like a senior leadership team. So I would be in the room with the Gore lawyers and the Democratic Party people until I was actually not allowed back in that room after like the fifth night, because I said they are going to steal this election, even though Al Gore won Florida. Al Gore won Florida. There's no question Al Gore won Florida. And literally, the Al Gore people were looking at me and several other people who were on the national staff of the AFL-CIO saying to us, we need to have a good image. We need to believe in civil society. We need to believe that the court process will be fair in this country. I don't know when the court process felt fair in my lifetime. It hasn't really. So the Democratic Party was complicit in the decisions in Florida that led directly to the seating of George Bush, number two. And they were complicit in several things in just from 2008 on. I'll give one more example of the Obama administration to be super clear. In 2006 and 2007, those of us who were campaigning tirelessly full time, as I was in the field, going into the 2008 presidential election, the message being put out by the Obama folks and by the National Labor Movement, for whom I have worked for decades now, was all we need to do is win the House, the White House plus 60. That's the lingo when you're in the field. We just need to win the White House plus 60. That's lingo for if we take the White House plus the Senate with at least 60 votes, a filibuster-proof majority, then we're going to win progressive labor law reform. That's what we believed we were working for when we went out to elect Obama, to take the White House and the Senate plus 60. We did it. We took it. We got nothing. We got nothing. They did not bring up the Employee Free Choice Act, which was the legislation that the labor movement was backing. Instead, they pushed through a, halfway decent, but on the margins, halfway decent Affordable Care Act, which we're going to lose now anyway, because the structurally important things they had to do, like shore up the ability of unions to organize, to expand the universe of people who can unify people of color in the working class with white people and actually get them to the polls, they decimated their base. The corporate wing of the Democratic Party has been eating its base systematically my entire lifetime.
Today, we are speaking with Jane McAlevey, longtime organizer, author, and scholar. She's the author of two books, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, and No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. She's working on her third, Striking Back. It's about organizing power and strategy. And this is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls. You brought up a lot there, Jane, and I think it's important to revisit the Merrick Garland nomination. Rolling Stone had a really good article and pointed out that Obama appointed a very moderate, older white man who he thought would appease the Republicans. And as a result, all of the groups that are historically connected to the Democratic Party, who have a lot of excited people who want to be involved, didn't get excited. It fell flat. They didn't call their congresspeople. They didn't call their senators. Cecile Richards, former head of Planned Parenthood, said, I guess we're going to wait till the hearing because we don't know much about this guy. And he just disappeared.
Yeah. And that also is a metaphor for one of the other problems with the neoliberal. It's kind of a weird word, so I'll just say the corporate class within the Democratic Party. The recommendation of Garland was exactly what Cecile Richards described it as. But can we just say that's a metaphor for many of the people that the National Democratic Party, the corporate wing of it, are nominating for office as well, right? So they nominate people that they think will be that they can appeal to sort of a moderate Republican in the suburbs to pull them over to our side. And what it actually does is it massively depresses the turnout from the natural kind of organic base that should be voting for the Democratic Party. So the Garland decision was one of them, right? Mm. Nominate someone who's milquetoast in a way that is unreliable, not clear, and certainly not exciting if you're someone whose job, as Cecile Richards was in Planned Parenthood, is partly to defend women's right to control our bodies. If you were a trade unionist, there was nothing exciting about it. We had no idea what the guy really meant. The people were like trying to read tea leaves to figure out Garland in the trade union sector as well. So it doesn't surprise me that at Planned Parenthood, they were trying to figure out who is this guy. And so it's kind of, there's like an arrogance in the corporate wing of the party, partly because they don't experience the pain that most people are experiencing. Mm-hmm. They are themselves rich. They are mostly white. They don't have to figure out how to get health care when the Affordable Care Act gets repealed. They don't figure out how to get their kid out of jail when their kid is needlessly or senselessly put in jail. It's not their kid who's being shot by a cop who pulls out a gun and shoots them when they have a taillight wrong. So they're just flat out of touch with most of the very real crises. Right? They're not drinking unhealthy water. They're not, everything that Scott Pruitt is undoing. They're living little sheltered lives, the corporate class inside the Democratic Party. And those sheltered lives make it so that they don't realize that Garland was going to be unexciting. They didn't realize that Hillary Clinton was going to be such a drag for so many people who needed to turn out at the polls in 2016. And the depression of that vote, I mean, part of why I predicted that Trump was going to win is because I was working in Philadelphia at the time. And the polls had her 17 points in the lead going into the DNC convention that was in Philadelphia. And I went on the record telling a Nation reporter and several others that she wasn't going to win Pennsylvania. And that was in July. And they literally all said to me, you're whacked, McAlevey. She's in the lead by 17 points. And I said, I'm on the doors in a campaign in seven hospitals with thousands of women in the healthcare sector who ain't voting for her. And the black people in Philadelphia, who they assumed would come out at the same percentage rate as they did for Obama, when this is a woman who they knew, who most black people actually understood, had taken the wrong position on the crime bill, had sent a lot of good jobs out of the United States as part of her husband, let's be real, right? Clinton's NAFTA policy, like she wanted to ride on his name. Well, there were also things that were bad that came with his name. And most American workers understood it. They saw the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, under Bill Clinton's watch, as well as the Omnibus Crime Act, as something that jailed most black people in this country instead of giving them good factory jobs that had a union.
Today, we're speaking with Jane McAlevey, longtime organizer, author, and scholar. We're having a wide-ranging conversation about the state of the Democratic Party, where we're at right now, minority rules. And Jane is working on her third book called Striking Back. It's about organizing, power, and strategy. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. Thank you. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with longtime organizer, author, and scholar Jane McAlevey. She is the author of Raising Expectations and Raising Hell and No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. Her forthcoming book, Striking Back, is about organizing, power, and strategy. Jane, have you ever had conversations with people who are part of the corporate wing of the Democratic Party about these issues?
Yeah, although I don't spend a lot of my time, I don't waste a lot of my time on them anymore. What I try to do is figure out how do we actually expand and grow the base of people. Mm. As the corporate Democrat have basically shedded responsibility for the working masses, I have increasingly devoted every minute of my life to how do we actually expand the universe of people who make up the progressive base, who should be voting for. You know, I mean, look, truthfully, I wish I had real choices. I wish I had a third or fourth or fifth party to vote for. Though I will say that now that I do a lot of work in Europe, I'm not sure that the multi-party system, which I used to fantasize was the solution, is necessarily the solution either. Yeah, no, really. I mean, look at Brexit. Look at what's going on. And if you look at the United Kingdom, where I'm doing a lot of work with unions now, if you look at France, where Macron is just decimating what we think of as the robust sort of the place we all want to live, right, the robust sort of social safety net that is France, that's being decimated by essentially a Clinton, Tony Blair, if we're talking about England, sort of wing of the party in France. So across the board, you sort of see this takeover of what used to be the more progressive political parties in the world, frankly. You see a takeover of them by super wealthy corporate-backed elite, because corporations, if you look at corporate giving, it's super clever, right? They who have so much money that they can afford to give to both Democrats and Republicans, they give wildly to both parties. Now, they give way more. They give like, I think they had three, quote me on this, but I'll say it, I think it's $3.4 billion is what corporations put into the 2016 election, and labor unions put in like $313 million. Mm-hmm. Roughly, that's the disparity. But what we put in is far more traditionally, right? We meaning the organized workers, which is bodies, right? Bodies to go out and like knock on doors, canvass, ring the phones, work the phone banks, and drag people out to the polls as is necessary in this country because there's such a lack of enthusiasm for these very paltry Garland-like Democrats that we put up. So, yeah. So I think in Florida, when I spent every night showing the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, the leadership of it, that if we didn't put people in the streets to make it very visible and clear that Gore slash the Democrats had won Florida, the right wing would literally be doing that really soon. And if you look at how history played out, they literally ended the Florida recount with a right-wing-led direct action. Most people don't even remember any of this, but I was in the room when it happened. They crashed, it was like a violent end to the Florida recount. They literally crashed in and began to throw tables and disrupt. This was like white nationalists, as I describe it in Raising Expectations, like carrying what was called the Christian Militants Bible. They were holding thousands and thousands of thousand-person marches, not just in Florida, but all across the country. And they literally began to use the slogan that some of us thought we should have used on day one, which is don't let them steal the election. That's what the right wing began to do. And they held protests all across the country. They were holding very big, increasingly big protests in Florida. And then they actually physically crashed the recount room and began to throw things in it was called the Brooks Brothers rally because they were all really well dressed and they were carrying Christian Militant Bibles. And they did a direct action, which is what let the Supreme Court step in when they had no jurisdiction because they said there's chaos in Florida. The Supreme Court, we're having a constitutional crisis. And they stepped in and actually took control of the decision of the Florida recount. And there was never one shred of legitimacy for the right-wing Supreme Court at that point to step in and take control of the presidential decision. So I banged my head every day with the lawyers and the elite of the corporate class of the party in 2000. And from then on, I said, my life work is going to be teaching the masses of workers how they actually win. Mm. Because there are certain things we have to do to win and certain things that we do by which we will consistently lose, right? And I'm an organizer. and a chief contract negotiator. And all of those things mean that I have to understand how to build power against a lot of opposition by super skilled right-wing forces. That is what every union fight in this country is. So that is where I spend my time talking with and engaging ordinary people across the rainbow of our society and trying to teach them how to win.
When it comes to building power, just because we're getting hit by so many sides all at once, George W. Bush appointed Samuel Alito and John Roberts to the court. Donald Trump appointed Neil Gorsuch, and he is going to appoint someone new, possibly a woman. And it is shocking to me that in about a year and a half, abortion might be illegal in 20 states.
I don't know why they keep saying 20, because this court will make it a national law. They will.
Eventually, yes.
Yes,
but I mean, like, California could be safe, but eventually it will. All right. So when you talk specifically about that issue, and it is shocking to me to hear these reporters so casually talk about Roe v. Wade being overturned when 70,000 women die every year from a botched abortion. I mean, we're talking about women and girls dying because of this. Okay, on that specific issue, how do you talk about building power around this?
So, there's a couple things. I just have to go sideways for a second because it was so tempting based on how you just framed it. It was so instructive to me in terms of talking about power and giving my daily power lesson, which I hope to do everywhere I go. So I've been going crazy as the liberal media has been saying. I think Tubin started it, right? The CNN commentator on the court that, you know, there'll be 20 states or 22 states where, you know, the right to make decisions about your body will be eliminated sometime in the next 18 months. And every time I hear someone say that, I think, no, not this court. No, they will find a way to engineer it so that there's a blanket national ban. So here's why. This is going to take me back to Janice for a minute. Mm-hmm. And then I want to come back to unions in power for a few minutes. So and why unions matter so much, despite people's little picky anything as they want to say about them in the liberals class. So we'll come back to that. So when it came to, and this is so instructive about Roe v. Wade, when it came to trade unions, the whole reason that they just engineered the Janus case that was ruled on us the last day of the year, last Wednesday, the whole reason that they had to work so carefully, and it was Alito. I mean, Alito literally was the brainchild behind wiping out, essentially trying to wipe out, he thinks wipe out, it's not going to happen, but he thinks wiping out unions, diminishing the power of working people. National labor law is governed two different ways. This is really relevant to power and Roe v. Wade, and I need people to think about this fast. So forever, since unions were legalized, and by the way, where they're really going is to make them illegal. So if we have time, let's come back to that, because that's what you can read in the decision is they're going after collective bargaining, period. Anything collective will be bad. So that's the setup of this case for the next case. But under labor law, we had the National Labor Relations Act. That's what governed so-called private sector unions. That's what was deemed lawful under the New Deal. By the way, Roosevelt hated the idea that public sector workers would have the right to a union. So he created a law for workers in the so-called private sector to have the right to a union. That's what the Wagner Act was. That's the basic backbone of national labor law in 1936, when unions became legal, collective bargaining became legal in the private sector nationally. Was for the so-called private sector. I say so-called because I don't think that there is a public sector and a private sector. I think it's all a bamboozle by capitalists to make us think that they're different sectors. So, so that's how labor law was governed, private sector, so-called private sector, national labor law, the National Relations Act. Public sector law, the law that governed workers who are teachers, firefighters, cops, et cetera, government workers of any kind, that's always been governed state by state. It's state law. So back to the analogy to Roe v. Wade, because there's a point line to this. So essentially, they've been eviscerating union rights in general for the last couple of decades, right? And Reagan, of course, was a huge blow when he replaced striking workers for the first time. They could always do that under the law, but he was the first person in this country at a high level to say, the workers went on strike. The air traffic control workers went on strike. I'm just going to fire all 11,000, and not just fire them, destroy their lives and their careers, which he did in 1981, right? Powerful moment of decimating unions. So meanwhile, fast forward again to Tubin's point and to people who are saying we're only going to lose the right to decide how to control our bodies in 22 states. I think it's going to be national. And here's how they did it in the labor law case. So they could never get at California. All the states where people are now assuming that women will maintain the right to have an abortion and or make decisions about their lives, are in the states that are the so-called blue states, right? California, Washington, Oregon, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Maine, you know, fill in a few others, Vermont, New Jersey, Washington, D.C., Maryland, those same states. So what they had to do to try to wipe out the power of the working class, of an organized working class, was Alito just engineered a case on First Amendment grounds, because he could never have come into California or Oregon or every one of the states that I just mentioned and made it so that workers didn't have to pay dues to the public sector unions. That would not have happened in California in our lifetime. Mm-hmm. So they engineered. These guys understand power so much better than most of the so-called progressives in this country, and certainly than the Democratic Party. They engineered it. They had to get so clever. If you read Kagan's dissent, she nails them on it, too. But, like, they had to be so clever to turn this into a First Amendment case, because otherwise they couldn't go after unions in the so-called blue states. So I just want – that's a long way of saying it's another lesson about power, and I don't think they're going to make it so that Roe v. Wade is simply overturned. They're going to engineer it so that no one in any state in this country in about 18 months has the right to do it. And I just want to say thanks to the Irish women and the trade union movement in Ireland, because at least rich people now will be flying to Ireland, you know, which is sick. But anyway, so – because in Ireland, they actually just did something that we don't have the power to do in this country either, which is they took it on as a constitutional issue in Ireland, when they repealed a constitutional measure limiting a woman's right to choose. But obviously that's only rich people who are going to be able to fly to Ireland now. But I digress on that for a minute. But I think it's really serious. I think they're too clever. They're much too smart. They wake up every morning. They have war rooms. They think about power and they think about strategy. And they are not just coming for the safe states on Roe v. Wade or anything else. They just figured out – these are the guys who say they're pro-states' rights, right? This is the states' rights court. They just – that's such a joke. They just bash the idea of states' rights by engineering an absurd argument, in the Janus case, to try and force it as a – First Amendment case so that they could get it into the Supreme Court and begin to challenge the power of unions in the blue states in this country. Mm. That's what they just did. That's what's like super extra duper clever in the power analysis of the super right wing, who, again, are doing all of this to cement their rule when the country is wildly not on their side.
So we just saw about 750 rallies over the weekend calling for the abolition of ICE, calling for an end to detaining children and their parents. I mean, let's get the families together, but let's not detain them. It's shocking to even think that we're going to get to a place where abortion is illegal in this country. When, it's weird to say this, but when this happens, we're going to see massive movements on the ground. What do you think will come of all of these actions?
You know, so first of all, I think we need a lot of actions. There's no question that we need direct action, as we did in Florida, right, in 2000, facing the Supreme Court. So, you know, action, direct actions, marches, protests serve a variety of useful tools as you're building power. One is if they're growing in size, that matters. I'm a little concerned about how things did or didn't appear on Saturday coming out against not just ripping babies away from innocent people seeking asylum, but the internment camps that they're starting to build so we can just lock up children forever with their parents. I mean, we are – the level of discussion is so sickening right now in this country. So demonstrations matter. Protests matter. The dilemma is they're never enough. They've never been enough. They're not enough. Nor is voting enough. Right. So where the corporate wing of the Democratic Party likes to go is like they flash that "we'll remember in November" thing. Then, by the way, they offer up candidates that couldn't excite, you know, a cockroach to like at the polls and expect people to be mobilized to go to the polls. OK, so Howie sees power back from a minority is going to be multifaceted. The more we understand power, the better strategy we make. So the reason why I write a lot about power in both books and in the next book, and by the way, there's a fourth one now. So all the books that I'm trying to spit out right now focus on power. Because I teach courses on power, certainly what Harvard Law School had me teaching right for a couple of years. Like they were like, develop that power theory into a teachable course. So the reason I'm so obsessed by teaching ordinary people about power is because you can't make good strategy if you don't understand power. So we're going to need demonstrations for sure. We're going to need people voting in record numbers all the time. But there's other things we're going to need. And the one that I want to link us back to is strikes. Mm. And it's the power of workers withdrawing their labor and walking off the job in unison. That's the economic lever by which we go after a virulent corporate class. So part of what was so encouraging about this spring and the reason why I am able to still have a kick in my step and a smile on my face despite the most dangerous moment of my lifetime is because of what happened in the six states that you, the list of which you read. In fact, we should add North Carolina to it, because mm-hmm. North Carolina put 35,000 people on the street in one day, and that's another southern state. So I'd like to talk about what it takes to get 35,000 people to walk out of school in southern states, right? These were all states that were very anti-union. In some cases that are super pro Jim Crow, and I think if they could have Jim Crow, they'd be back there tomorrow in some cases, right? So what's encouraging to me, and it's the third leg of the stool, right? If we have to vote, we have to do direct actions. There's something very important we have to do in this country, and many liberals need to get over their hesitancy about it, and that is stand up and support trade unions in this country. Mm-hmm. Imperfect as they are, we have no perfect movement, by the way, last I looked. I could rattle off a long list of imperfections. We're human, so we're imperfect, right? So all of our movements are also occasionally imperfect. But liberals, including, I'm sure, some people who listen to your call, will quickly start to bash unions in ways that's fascinating to me. Whenever I'm in the Bay Area, because I split my life, I'm mostly not here, though I'm technically I call this home. I drop in every few months a year. But whenever I'm here, you know, there's way too many people who send money to Tibet, eat organic food, drive electric cars, and then in the same breath start bashing teacher unions. And I'm done with that, okay? Because unions are, in some ways, the single most important institution that undergirds a working class's ability to have power. And this is capitalism. We live under a political and economic system called capitalism. What the game changer in the civil rights movement was not, I hate to say, people standing up and having protests. There's so many good books about this, and I talk about it in No Shortcuts. What brought down the white power regime in the southern states were very specific protests where they went after the economic fortunes of Fortune 500 who were based in the South. So going after the corporate capitalist class in a political economic system called capitalism means we need strong unions, means liberals and lefties need to put away their distaste for something, and they've bought into the rhetoric and realize that when we have been doing decently in this country, it's because unions actually can unify Black, Brown, women, men, and everyone into collective fights for that which is best for all of the working class, which is why the Supreme Court has been steadily attacking unions my entire adult lifetime.
How does the Janus decision affect union organizing?
You know, it's an interesting, rich, and complicated answer to that question. But it doesn't. In some ways, what good organizers do is we figure out how to build what's called 90% unity in the workplace. Now, that might seem a bit strange, although I do talk a lot about it in No Shortcuts, and I actually talk about it in both books. So what's interesting to me is if you want to have a successful strike, if you want to do what they did in West Virginia, and actually you said 20,000, which is right, 20,000 teachers, but I wanted to come back to that for 1 second, because part of what was so powerful about West Virginia is it wasn't just 20,000 teachers. 14,000 service workers who were the cooks and the bus drivers mm-hmm. walked off the job with them. So it was 34,000 mm-hmm. workers in West Virginia, and that's getting buried in the news because people keep calling it a teacher strike, and I keep saying it's an education strike.
Right.
And part of why it matters, it isn't just a semantic point, is because in the stories I wrote in The Nation, two feature stories about the strikes this spring in the education sector in West Virginia, which is the one that I have analyzed the most deeply, and it will show up in the next books. So I keep analyzing it with folks there, and it'd be good to come forward about what's happening in those states right now as it's sort of summertime. There's a lot going on in the strike states, which is super exciting. So what was so important about that is it's the kind of strike we need. It was what we call an industrial model strike, meaning all the workers understood their class interest. Teachers didn't peel off and pretend to be professionals, because teachers are working class in this country, last I looked. Even though capitalism would like them to believe they're professionals, they're getting their paycheck from someone. They're not super rich. They're part of the working class. So there's this idea of playing the professional class against the ordinary workers, like the cooks and the bus drivers. What's beautiful about West Virginia is, first of all, class consciousness is just a bit different there for lots of historic reasons. Second of all, when I was interviewing the superintendents of the school. So these are the employer side of it, right? They're actually the bosses in the decision-making about the strikes in West Virginia. I started to cold call superintendents during the nine-day strike because I knew I was going to start writing about West Virginia because it was so unbelievably important and exciting. And as I was calling into the superintendents, I was just cold calling. And West Virginia is a little state, and I don't think many national people call superintendents, so they kept answering their phones. And I said, so why is it there's been no legal injunction? Because the strike's illegal. The strike was fully illegal. By the way, we need lots of fully illegal strikes, but don't just go out there alone and do it yourself, because you need to have everyone with you, which they did in West Virginia, right? You have to build to that kind of unity, then you can hold an illegal strike. So what the superintendent said was, look, ma'am, they're always ma'aming me, calling into the South, they would say, listen, ma'am, very proper. They would say, the truth is, if just the teachers went on strike, there would be school right now. And we'd be moving much faster, essentially, towards having a legal injunction to force them back to work. The reason that they couldn't force them back to work is because the bus drivers and the cooks walked out. And it's a rural state. And when the first superintendent said to me on day three, when I said to him, he said, I'm not going to talk to you on the record. Some did. This was an off-the-record interview. And I said, tell me why there's no legal injunction against an illegal strike in a Southern right-to-work state. And he said, because the bus drivers aren't picking up the kids. And if one kid gets hurt, left on the side of the street, run over, walks out, trips, the superintendents will be screwed. Mm. So the teachers in West Virginia know this, but the rest of the country doesn't understand that part of the power of the West Virginia strike was because it was an industrial model strike, by which I mean all the workers together walked off the job. And when the progressive teachers who led that strike, they made it was a bottom-up movement, totally bottom-up. This was not called by what I call the position holders and the state bureaucracy of the unions. It was a grassroots movement from below. And what the grassroots teacher said is, we're frustrated by what our own unions have been accepting in the past. We're going to make our unions behave the way we want our unions to behave. That's a note to self, everyone listening. Make your union behave the way you want it to behave. A union is a small mini democracy, so you just need to get in there and take control of it like the workers did in West Virginia. And they said, we're going to run strike votes. We're going to run our strike votes across all the unions and all the workers in the schools. That is not how strike votes were traditionally held. Usually just the teachers would go, or just the cooks and bus drivers. And so a bunch of radical teachers said, we're going to hold the strike votes across all the workers in the schools. And they told their union leadership, that's how we're running our strike votes. Mm. And so they had an all-out strike. And all-out strikes are what brought us better times in this country about 8 decades ago. Mm.
Jane McAlevey is a longtime organizer, author, and scholar, and the time always flies when you're on, Jane. I want to make sure that I get your take on what's happening with New York City drivers, because I've been watching this so closely, and I'm shocked that it's not on the front page of the papers on a regular basis. Abdul Saleh recently hanged himself in his rented room in Brooklyn. He is the sixth driver to take his own life since September. According to reports, he was $300 short on lease payments on his vehicle. Like so many drivers, he was working 12-hour night shifts. I still take cabs, and I always interview every cab driver here in San Francisco. And they all say that since Uber and Lyft have flooded our streets about 40,000 cars a day, their pay has been cut in half. And the only reason why we haven't seen this in San Francisco is because the cab drivers still have the airport. But if they lose that, then they said they will not be surprised if someone doesn't take their life. So, but we've also had Uber and Lyft drivers on the show who are so tired of working long hours and barely making ends meet. What do you think about this?
Yeah, so I think it's disgusting. I actually was you know, whatever. I've just finally got my first ever social media handle. Rose will know that I'm generally opposed to social media. I think it's a distraction for most of us. But I mean, I was tweeting about the sixth driver because it just it broke my heart and it spoke to the crisis of the moment. We are that's what I mean about the corporate Democratic elite being tone deaf to the level of misery going on in this country. So the first thing I want to say is I was just working with Canadian unions in BC, in British Columbia. That's a big province, okay? It's like the second biggest province, I think, population-wise. I mean, population-wise, there's some big provinces in Canada. It's a big country. But British Columbia, where Vancouver sits, hip Pacific Coast, West Coast city in a hip ish kind of province. British Columbia is a lot like California. There's a little red zone in there, but it's mostly pretty what we would think of as blue. Do you know what's not legal in Vancouver or British Columbia?
Uber and Lyft.
Uber and Lyft. So, and in London, where I'm spending a lot of time working with unions, trying to figure out how to save the National Health Service, the NHS, from the onslaught of attacks by the right wing, they did just technically give them the right to have their license again. But I'm putting my money on the taxicab drivers and the workers' rights movement in London to take that back, because all you have to know is in British Columbia, it's not legal to have Uber and Lyft, and they are not there, and you do not have hardworking taxi drivers committing suicide in British Columbia for a reason, which is they have stronger laws than we do. They're not afraid to regulate the economy. And, you know, Uber, well, I said to friends of mine, I've actually have friends. This is like the thing about driving electric cars, eating organic food, and then bashing a union and just not and just being clueless about why unions are so desperately needed in this country. When a friend says to me, I'll call a cab for you, the first thing I say is I look them in the eye and I say, are you calling a cab for me or something else? And if they say Uber, I have threatened to break their phone on the spot and smash it with my high heels. And I will do that because Uber is evil. The company needs to go away. There is, I'm happy to debate anyone, anywhere about what Uber is, what the theory of neoliberal Jeff Bezos, you know, move fast and break things, anti-regulation. People need to stop seeing Silicon Valley as hip and cool. It is as destructive as Wall Street.
Mm. 1 minute left, Jane. People are very frustrated right now. I'd love to have you back because we want to talk about the victory of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York. And of course, there's a debate going on about power inside the party versus outside. I think you'd be fantastic for that. But can you just leave us with some final thoughts? Because it's just coming at us so quickly.
Yeah. First of all, it was super exciting. I was in New York. Super exciting. So Alexandria, oh, my God, it was such a great night in the sea of a terrible week. So there are people winning all over the country. Three women who they thought wouldn't win, one in Pennsylvania. 50. I'm going to come back to the teacher strikes and unions because that is the main thing I'm still trying to say in my last few seconds here. In Oklahoma on Thursday, 50 teachers, 100 teachers ran for office in Oklahoma after they they let them win a $6,000 raise, but they put through a corporate tax decrease and the teachers are trying to campaign against that. And 50 teachers, just one office in the primary stage.
Wow.
And every single Republican legislator in the state of Oklahoma, I'm having chills on my arm from this, every single Republican who voted against the teachers' raise in Oklahoma during their strike just lost office or got sent to a primary, like a two-way runoff.
Wow.
And there was a massive sea change in Oklahoma on the heels of Alexandria winning. So people are ready, and unions matter, and strikes matter, and that's the message of Oklahoma.
Jane McAlevey is an organizer, author, and scholar. Her forthcoming book is Striking Back. It's about organizing power and strategy. Jane, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.